Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Matt Larson has served as the athletics director at North Dakota State University since October of 2014. His office guides development of athletic facilities, assists with fundraising, scholarships, plans, budgets, and oversees athletic department staff, including coaches. He came to Fargo from Stony Brook University in New York, where he was the athletic department's chief financial officer. Matt, welcome to Main Street.
No, appreciate you having me on. Excited for our conversation.
There is so much to talk about in the world of college sports, and then, of course, a lot to talk about with the North Dakota State University Bison. Let's start in the greater world of college sports. This question is whether college athletes are employees. The NCAA now will ask a federal appeals court, likely in February, to block a lawsuit that seeks to have athletes treated as employees and then paid for their time. That would be devastating to college athletics.
Well, I think there's so many moving parts on this conversation from one of the things that's been a hallmark and I think some of the attraction of NCAA competition for years is the amateurism piece. You know, these are young men and women who are going to school, earning education. The large majority of them are not going on to play professional sports. And so it's an entryway for a lot of kids to get an education. You know, athletics has been an entryway. And I live it every day. So I'm very, very much a fan of the amateur model. I don't think they're employees. And I think the interesting part is once you start getting into labor law, too, is I think student athletes have to be careful with wanting to become employees, because then they're going to be treated very differently. You know, the scholarship that they get will be taxed, all the other additional benefits that they get, just like any other employee, you're going to be taxed on. So those are all taxable benefits, and you can be hired and fired like any normal employee. So it's really interesting to see if we head down that road. I'm obviously hopeful that Congress is able to step in and grant some sort of antitrust protection for the NCAA, in particular with the amateurism piece.
And I want your take on Charlie Baker. He's the former Massachusetts governor now who will become the NCAA president. He said this about that issue. He said, remember, the vast majority of kids who play sports in college do not play sports in high school, et cetera, like you said. But he asked the question, why isn't a mathematician an employee who's on scholarship? Why isn't a trombone player who's on scholarship an employee?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, part of what we've tried to do over the years is have, you know, student athletes, you know, treated the same as general students, because in a lot of ways they are, expectations are the same in some cases. And so, no, I think that's a great argument. And I think that's where the NCAA kind of broke the mold with his hiring. Traditionally, or at least historically, NCAA presidents have been presidents of universities that have then transitioned into that role. And I think it was certainly intentional with a lot of forethought of having somebody who is very well versed in the political landscape, you know, being the former governor of the state of Massachusetts, a Republican in a very Democratic state, and was able to work on big issues and build consensus. And so that's what the hope, I think, here is having somebody who's very savvy in the political world being help us navigate kind of the future of college athletics.
Matt, how relevant is the NCAA? And I ask it from this perspective. To me, so much money, and now with a new media deal coming forward, especially in college football, coming at us, I think, in a year or two. So much money being pushed now into the sport. How relevant is the NCAA still?
Well, I think, and again, this is part of the problem that I think the NCAA and a lot of our institutions, where we probably miss the mark a little bit, is so much of the public perception is Alabama, is North Carolina, is Michigan, where those are institutions that are going to have $150, $200 million budgets. When, you know, in Division I, there's 365-ish around there, Division I institutions. The vast majority, I would say probably 300 of those schools, have operating budgets way below $100 million. And so I think the public perception, again, is of all of this money being pumped into college athletics, all these coaches. For every Nick Saban who makes $10 million, there's thousands of football coaches that make $50,000. And so I think we've lost the narrative a little bit from a college athletics perspective of educating the public that college athletics is not Alabama. You know, there's Division I, Division II, Division III, where student athletes are coming to institutions having an unbelievable experience through college athletics, getting a great degree, not playing professional sports, and going on to great careers. And so that's the part that we've lost. And a lot of that falls on us collectively as the NCAA and as institutions. We've lost that narrative a little bit.
You talked about amateurism briefly just a moment ago, and we've all heard now the term NIL, name, image, and likeness. An athlete now can be compensated for his name, image, and likeness. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are some Bison athletes who are mm-hmm. taking advantage of mm-hmm. that. What's your take on that? In my mind, it's really made a Wild West in some mm-hmm. sort of way relative to recruiting, retention of athletes, maybe yeah. not so much at a smaller school like NDSU than like mm-hmm. the larger schools you talked mm-hmm. about. Is it still clouding the way athletics operates?
Well, in a lot of ways, I mean, the initial concept of NIL I was very in favor of, and it was the idea of, so historically, you know, if you had a general student who was a great musician, they could go out and they could get paid for their talents. They could teach lessons. They could do all those things. Well, student athletes were always restricted from being able to do those things. They couldn't pay to sign an autograph. They couldn't go. If I'm a basketball player, I couldn't do a basketball camp. I couldn't give a young kid in the community lessons and be paid for it. And so a lot of it was trying to say, hey, you know what? These kids have talents. They should be able to monetize those just like any other undergraduate student at a university can do. Where things kind of went haywire a little bit was when they started becoming recruiting inducements. You have collectives that are starting all over the country.
Which they're not technically supposed to be.
Correct. These are not supposed to be recruiting inducements. And that's what we're seeing. And again, I go back to so much of the most recent legislation in NCAA, a lot of the NIL. This all has to do with probably 1% of the student athletes that compete at the NCAA level. It's your largest, and particularly in football and basketball. It's the at the highest level, those most elite athletes that this is really impacting, where you're seeing, you know, $1 million deals being struck by collectives for a kid who's never even played a snap or a second at an institution. So to me, those are absolutely recruiting inducements. So that's where it kind of went haywire. The initial concept of NIL, fully support. I think it made a lot of sense. And, you know, as with a lot of rules, though, things, you know, people find loopholes and try to do things differently to gain an advantage.
So what happens at NDSU? I own a bank. Or mm-hmm. I own a car dealership, or I own whatever, mm-hmm. and I want that athlete, that volleyball mm-hmm. player, that football player to do this for me, and I'm going to pay him or her for mm-hmm. that. Do I strike the deal on side? Are they canceled to go through your office so you've got reins on this? How does mm-hmm. that work?
Well, so an athletic department is not allowed to negotiate, set up, assist with any of these types of things.
So this is between the athlete then?
So a local business could contact a student athlete and say, hey, I'd love to have you do an advertising deal. I'd love to have you come by my business and sign autographs for an hour, and this is what I'll pay you. The one thing we ask is our student athletes are required to submit that information to us just so we can monitor it and make sure there aren't any issues, aren't any things that may impact negatively on their eligibility, those kinds of things. But yes, I mean, we can't get in the middle and try to negotiate those things or set those things up for our student athletes. It's really on them, or it's on the business to contact them directly.
Now we have this thing called the transfer portal. Mm-hmm. And I remarked off mic before we started, if we would have visited 5 years ago and I would have said transfer portal to you, you might have looked at me funny, or mm-hmm. NIL, you would have mm-hmm. looked at me funny. And these are impacting college sports. A kid can come in and play at NDSU next year if he comes mm-hmm. from somewhere else, or leave NDSU and mm-hmm. go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. What's your take on the transfer portal?
Well, again, I think the transfer portal in concept was a good thing. And I think sometimes the transfer portal probably gets a lot of negative feedback. But all the transfer portal is, it is a mechanism for student athletes to be able to put their name out there. Before the transfer portal, a student athlete would come in and say they're going to transfer. But it was really, really hard for coaches across the country to know who's transferring, who isn't. The student athlete had to contact the program they maybe wanted to go to. Where now, it's a way where student athletes, once they enter, their name is listed in this database, and you have coaches from institutions across the country that can see that can view that. Contact information is in there. Grade point averages are in there, all of those things. So it's much more user-friendly. It's better for the institution, and it's better for the student-athlete. Where the transfer portal, I think, has wrongly gotten a lot of negative attention, it's not so much the transfer portal. It's the transfer portal coupled with one-time transfer exception now in all sports in the NCAA. Previously, about 2 years ago, student-athletes in men's, women's basketball, football, baseball, hockey, if they were going to transfer their first time, they had to have a year of residency where they couldn't compete, and that counted towards their five-year clock of eligibility. That was removed 2 years ago, and so when you couple being able to leave and play right away, which could not being able to play right away was a little bit of a deterrent to transfer, but be able to leave and play right away your first time, and then you package NIL with that, that's what's made the whole recruiting – or the, excuse me, the transfer landscape – I guess, what people would consider out of control. In a lot of ways, it is.
Philosophically, as an institution, do you sit down and talk about, you know, we would rather recruit high school seniors the way we traditionally mm-hmm. have in the past, mm-hmm. or we do need to spend time in the transfer portal to keep up with the Joneses mm-hmm. to see what's out there? Where's that balance?
Yeah, well, I think philosophically for us, NDSU has always been a developmental program. You know, we've always gone the route of recruiting high school seniors that come in, you develop them over the course of their time. And, you know, very rarely, even, you know, when I first got here about 9 years ago, we had very few transfers that we would recruit to come in. And I think we're still a developmental program in a lot of different ways, but, you know, you and I talked a little bit off the air before we started. You know, a coach may go into a season feeling really good about where their roster is, knowing, hey, I have these freshmen that are coming in next year, and at the end of the season, a player comes in, maybe a junior or senior, whatever it may be, comes in and says, hey, by the way, I'm entering the transfer portal. And so that's where I think that philosophy has changed a little bit, because you don't want to be – you could very easily go out and try to sign another freshman, but there also has to be some balance to your classes. You know, you want to have – usually you want to have some balance between freshmen, sophomore, juniors, and seniors. You don't want to have a really heavy freshman class or a really heavy senior class. So you try to have some balance. So if a coach loses a junior to the transfer portal, they may go into the transfer portal, try to find maybe a junior to be able to come in. Again, that's going to fit our program, fit our style, those kinds of things that can supplement and then also balance out our classes.
I've noticed as a fan, it makes me have questions in my mind when I look at a school and say, geez, there's 26 guys now that aren't mm-hmm. going to be back next mm-hmm. year. 10 of them played. Mm-hmm. What is going on? Mm-hmm. Are you worried about that kind of stuff?
You know, there's certainly public perception. I think anytime you have people leaving, people are like, well, why are they leaving? And a lot of times it could be for a lot of reasons. It could be maybe they don't see themselves having a playing opportunity at NDSU or whatever the institution is. Or maybe they do want to go try their talent somewhere. So there could be a myriad of reasons. The one thing I always fall back on and feel really good about is I know our kids have a really good experience at NDSU. They're treated really well. We invest in them, not just in their sport, but academically, socially, education, all of those kinds of things, because our job is to prepare them for when they leave here. And so I feel really good about the experience they're having here. And so I never worry about NDSU getting a bad reputation that student athletes aren't treated properly here, because that couldn't be further from the truth.
We're enjoying our conversation with Matt Larson. He's the director of athletics at North Dakota State University. Matt, the Bison participate in the Summit League. Mm-hmm. Every now and again, especially in football, we read that, you know what, it's time to go elsewhere. Yeah. It's time to step it up a notch and climb the ladder. What are your thoughts about that in going to, say, trying to go to a Mountain West Conference, if you yeah. will, in the FBS?
Well, really, really unique. I mean, our all-sport conference is the Summit League. We have we play in a single-sport conference for football, the Missouri Life Football Conference, and then we're an associate member in the Big 12 for wrestling. So we're kind of scattered a little bit as it is. And honestly, the Summit League has been a great home for us. You know, when you look at some of our traditional rivals, even back in our Division II days, they're in the Summit League.
And great so, regional rivals.
Absolutely. Yep. Geographically, regionally, the league makes a lot of sense. You know, but I think as, you know, anybody, especially as we talked about earlier, there's so much change in college athletics. You know, the transformation committee completed their work, and a lot of recommendations have come out of there that are still need to be vetted out about what does it mean to be a Division I institution? What are some additional investments that institutions need to make on behalf of their student athletes? And so I think it's a really interesting time. And so these are great times for us to evaluate where we are, where do we want to be, not just next year, but where do we want to be the next 50 years from now? And so we look really closely at those things. And, you know, I say all that with, we may be in the Summit League for the next 50 years, but if there's other opportunities that make more sense for us as an institution, as a land-grant state institution, then I think you always have to look at those opportunities. And that's not – that doesn't mean to minimize the Summit League. It's been a great place and will continue to be a great place, or minimize where we play football. But I think you always have to look down the road, and sometimes you have to look at what's in the best interest of NDSU.
Sometimes these decisions almost come out of left field when you're just looking at things from a national perspective, and all of a sudden, here we go, Texas, here we go, Oklahoma, mm-hmm. you're in the SEC. Well, mm-hmm. geez, didn't see that coming, or maybe you did. USC, UCLA, all of these movements that happen. But even at mid-major levels, this stuff happens. BYU is an example. Mm-hmm. Could this be something that could happen in a year or two if you got the right call?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think timing, what we've learned, if we've learned anything in the last probably 6 or 7 years, this stuff happens really, really quick. And the one thing I've said that where I think we've done a good job at NDSU is we've continued to invest in our infrastructure. We've invested in our people. So we've built, you know, $110 million worth of facilities in the last 8 years. And so those have been huge upgrades, you know, for us that serve us really well where we are now, and who knows what the future may hold. But I've also invested in our staffing, in our operating, all of those things that, you know, put us in a really good position where I think people nationally are talking about what's next for NDSU. You know, if we hadn't done some of those things, we're probably not part of those conversations. And, you know, like I said, at the end of the day, it doesn't mean we're going anywhere or doing anything, but we're in those conversations because of the success we've had across the board in all of our sports. I think our national fan base, and because of the investments that we've put into our athletics program, I think people see it as, wow, NDSU is a place that, as people are looking to expand and expand their leagues, NDSU is probably places an institution they would consider.
I want to talk to you about marketing. There's an article in the Fargo Inform about why fans don't go to college basketball games anymore. Mm-hmm. And specifically, it said, hey, they ought to show up to the one that's coming up for the Bison, because right. It's going to be a great game. Mm-hmm. What the heck's going on? We ought to be able to fill the place, and we don't. Attendance has dropped nationwide. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, I think there's a combination of things. I think one is probably there's a lot of things to do in Fargo or in a lot of these smaller communities. There's a lot of things to do. So I think people are pulled in a number of different directions. I also think access to be able to consume games is much greater than it's ever been. Whether you
to
watch
the detriment
it on
of attendance, whether, maybe,
yeah, whether yeah. you watch it on TV, whether you stream it, whether you however you consume it, there's an opportunity to do that. And I know back in my early days in college athletics, boy, anytime you could get on TV was awesome because you wanted to get your brand out there. You wanted to – that meant something. And I think we're seeing now – and obviously there's revenue tied to it and all of those things. But what I think you're seeing now is people are having to decide, do I go there, sit at the venue, pay, buy a ticket, all of those things, or – do I sit at home and watch the game? And so I think that plays into a little bit. I think people's schedules are much more hectic than they've ever been. There's a lot of things pulling at their entertainment dollar. And I think that the ease of access, I think, has played into why we're seeing fewer people go to basketball games.
Are you happy with the venues? Talk about the Fargo Dome first.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a great college football arena? Or do you wish maybe that some upgrades would come your way? Or maybe as we plan down the road, like we talked about earlier, we need to maybe think about a different football venue.
I mean, it's been a great facility, and we're fortunate. We have a great relationship with the Fargo Dome staff. It's owned and operated by the city of Fargo, and so it's been a really good partnership. Just celebrated its 30th anniversary in December, and so I think like any facility after 30 years probably needs upgrades and some enhancements and some of those things. So I think those are some of the conversations we're having now with the Fargo Dome and the city is what's next for the Fargo Dome. You know, so much of this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I think when you go to professional facilities or newer college facilities, there's a lot going on. And again, because everybody that goes to a game doesn't consume it the same way. There's the person who's going to sit in their seat and watch every single play and not miss a thing. And then you have folks that like to be at the game, like to watch it, maybe like to be in a club area, like to be in a suite. And so having some of those other premium opportunities or other hospitality type things, I think really help a lot. And so those are some of the things right now as the Fargo Dome is currently configured it doesn't have. And so hopefully those are things that we can work on in the future.
Matt, let's talk about budgeting for just a moment. Mm-hmm. If you were to tell me, you know, we need to enhance our budget in this place or that place, talked about revenue opportunities, perhaps in some things that could happen in the Fargo Dome.
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell me in order for this university to be where it wants to be in athletics, we need to enhance our revenue?
Well, I think revenue is always conversations we're having, you know, in college athletics, because most anytime you're gonna enhance those revenues, usually typically come externally, you know, whether that's through ticket sales, whether that's through donations, whatever it might be. And so, you know, for us, where we've been fortunate in my time here, all of our programs are fully funded at the maximum scholarship level from the NCAA. We do cost of attendance, so we're in a really good place there. I think in terms of some personnel and some salaries, I think we're very competitive, certainly at our level where we compensate our coaches and student athletes. You know, our philosophy has always been we're going to fund our programs to compete for championships within the leagues that they play in. So there's certainly things that we're doing there. I would say where And again, this goes into, I think, where things are trending towards, you know, this holistic model that the NCAA is moving towards from an NCAA, from a Division I standpoint is investments in mental health support, investments in in nutrition, investments in diversity, equity, and inclusion, some of those areas where we are going to be mandated down the road, and probably rightfully so, to have positions in place dedicated to student athletes, some of those areas, career development, all the things that go in preparing student athletes, not just to compete, not just to do well academically, but all of the other pieces that we can help develop them. And so I think those are the areas where and we're starting to head in that direction where some of that investment needs to go into. And again, it goes back to that holistic model that the NCAA is moving forward on.
Do you feel that's achievable to accomplish those things? And I ask that in the context of your budget, about $25 million or so a year, give or take. Where I came from, the University of Wyoming, their budget is about 40-some million, give or take. They play in the Mountain West Conference, of course. Does that gap concern you when you look at where the program may want to be in the future? That's a big gap in my eyes.
Well, I mean, right now, the gap doesn't concern me. I think we, like I said earlier, I think we provide a really good experience for our student athletes. We fund them well. We invest in theirs. We invest in them to be able to compete for championships. Obviously, if you're looking at trying to elevate to a different level, there's a lot of pieces that go into that, whether it's additional staff members, whether it's additional scholarships, some of those things. I think that's where a lot of that gap comes in. Some of the things that are required at that next level of competition. So those are things that if we ever decided to do that, we would absolutely have to generate more revenue to be able to fund those things at a high level and at a level that we can compete for champions at. I will say this. I tell you, our wrestling program this year is competing at a really, really high level. So and we always have great bouts with Wyoming, so it should be a lot of fun to watch.
Matt Larson, the Director of Athletics at North Dakota State University. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the John and Elaine Andrist Charitable Trust, supporting the communities of Northwest North Dakota. Information at nwndcommunityfoundation.org. The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus presents its Valentine's Serenade on Tuesday, February 14th at 7 p.m. at 1603 Main Events. Chorus members perform romantic songs from Broadway, country, jazz, and popular music. The night includes a buffet dinner, wine tasting, trivia, and private serenades. Reserve your spot at this exciting event with your sweetheart or a group of friends and family. Tickets are available at bismancivicchorus.com and must be purchased in advance. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
More Main Street after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A bill signed by Governor Doug Burgum will expand workers' compensation benefits for police and firefighters. State law had required those officers to have worked in North Dakota for 5 years before they would be covered by workforce safety and insurance for such things as cardiac events and cancer treatments. Lawmakers from West Fargo introduced a bill to make a change after a firefighter and a police officer suffered heart attacks. Both had been in North Dakota less than 5 years, but had experience in other states. Burgum signed the bill on Monday.
If you've worked in law enforcement, if you've been a firefighter in another state, if you moved to North Dakota, you know that you're not going to have to wait 5 years to get the support and the coverage you need for you and your family. And so I think this is an important signal that we're sending.
Art Thompson is the Director of Workforce Safety and Insurance.
With the signing of this legislation today, I'm proud to say that North Dakota will be the only state in the country that will have this benefit level for the men and women who put on law enforcement uniforms and firefighting gear to protect our great state.
The bill, House Bill 1279, passed both houses unanimously. It took effect right after Burgum signed it. North Dakota's House Majority Leader says there may be some tweaks to what Governor Burgum proposed in the terms of a flat income tax. Burgum proposed a 1.5% flat tax with some lower income people paying no tax. Dickinson Republican Representative Mike LaFour says there have been some informal discussions with his House caucus as well as with Senate leadership.
The discussions were, how do we put more dollars in relief to North Dakota citizens as opposed to non-residents?
LaFour says Burgum's proposal has a $566 million price tag.
What we're looking at right now, and what I believe Chairman Craig Hedlund of House Finance and Tax is going to move forward with, is a 2% flat tax. But embedded in that 2% flat tax would be about $265 million of tax credits so that the lowest tier for North Dakota citizens actually goes away.
LaFleur says the total dollar amount going to non-North Dakota citizens will be at $10 million. He says this would mean $371 million in tax relief to North Dakotans. And Duluth-based Elite and Grid United will be developing a new approximately 385-mile-long high-voltage direct current transmission line from central North Dakota to Colstrip, Montana. It's called the North Plains Connector, and it will be the nation's first transmission connection between three regional energy markets. MISO, the Mid-Continent Independent Systems Operator, the Southwest Power Pool, and the Western Interconnection. The two organizations say the DC line will create another 3,000 megawatts of transfer capacity. Julie Pierce is the Vice President of Strategy and Planning for Elite.
The grid is full. It's full of, you know, the energy-rich resources that we've been building to serve our growing loads and new types of generation coming on and offline. And it's time for significant infrastructure to be built. And the North Plains Connector really fits into that thesis and the need for additional ways to move energy around this country.
The companies expect to begin the project permitting process this year for the $2.5 billion project. They're projecting an in-service date of 2029. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Humanities North Dakota is presenting public university instructors who have virtual classes being offered this spring, and we are pleased to be joined by Rafi Andonian, who is teaching Contested Histories in Remembering Americana, which helps answer the question, what makes historic sites, monuments, curriculums, publications, films, and symbols so controversial? Rafi is a frequent guest on ABC, NBC, Fox, and CBS TV shows across the nation, and also produces and hosts his own streaming TV show that aims to challenge the present by inquiring about the past. Rafi, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you guys for having me on. What a great topic and show to be on.
You are presenting a 13-week virtual class that will use a Zoom platform beginning February 8th through Humanities North Dakota. Rafi, what is it that you're going to present?
What we do in the program is we talk through different topics and themes in American history that we often maybe contest and fight over in our memories, in our discussions. The way this started was that we had, you know, there was a previous version of this course in the aftermath of the contest over historical monuments and, you know, monuments being put up, torn down, et cetera, these debates. And what I recognized was there was really a debate on, you know, the memory of how these particular people or events were remembered. So based on that, we built this class or this course that, you know, said, okay, well, let's look beyond just this individual monuments, but the larger narratives that we fight over behind it. And that's how we came up with the course. And so the presentations are each different vignettes, if you will, on different topics in American history, usually with a guest speaker that I get in as an expert in that particular area. And I set up and facilitate. We do a presentation for about a half hour from the guest speaker and then an hour of Q&A discussion after that. So it's very Q&A and discussion oriented. It's very interactive and active in the way that we learn.
I was thinking about how I consume history, and I recall my history classes in middle school and high school. I did not take a history class at university for my particular major. It wasn't required, so I guess I just didn't do it other than maybe a political science class. But after that, we don't have a formal method to consume history as we get older. How do you find that folks consume history once they've left schools?
I love that you asked that question because that is precisely the crux of what gets, you know, explored in this class, because the way we consume history when we're out and about after the classroom, let's say you did take a class on history, a lot of people have a very poor recollection of their history class experience, maybe a bad teacher or at least, you know, having to memorize names and dates. It's much more than names and dates. It's about themes and concepts. So first of all, I think even in the classroom, it's not necessarily always ideal, depending on who's teaching it, how it's being taught, etc. But once we get out of school, I would say the primary way we consume history is pop culture and in our political rhetoric. Those are the two primary ways. And I'll give you a couple examples. Pop culture, of course, movies, sometimes paintings. You can probably think of historic, you know, iconic paintings in American history that we, you know, George Washington crossing the Delaware, for example. So this has been going on for generations, having different images that influence how we think of things. Of course, movies, right? There's movies all the time coming out that are, you know, historically based in terms of the theme they're portraying, whether it's, you know, Saving Private Ryan in World War II or the movie Gettysburg or Cold Mountain, you know, an Academy Award winner, you know, more recently Lincoln and, I think 12 Years a Slave, you know, these are all top movies that, you know, depict history, at least help us, or at least how we consume history. They're not necessarily historically accurate. How about Westerns, right? Westerns, cowboys and Indians, those kinds of films are constantly all around us. You and I weren't around during the American Civil War or the Revolution or in the days of the Westerns, but it helps shape how we remember culturally, how we remember the memory part, the past, and how we think we remember the past and what we know or what we think we know about the past. And that's where you start to have these issues, because the way you interpret and remember is going to be maybe different than I do. Of course, monuments are another form of culture. I don't know if you want to call it pop culture, but they are representations of the past. And that's when these issues start to pop up. So I think, you know, we have to think about how we consume history. Now, I'll add an example from political rhetoric. All the time in politics, you hear, you know, XYZ policy is correct, is the right thing to do because that's what America stands for. ABC is what America is about. And that is referring to some notion of what you see as your identity as a member of that community, whether it's a nation, the state, or even the city. And usually that has some sort of intertwining with history. It may not be a direct history statement, but that cultural identity comes from some kind of common understanding of history. And that's where we can disagree, right? You might think it means to be this, you have to be this way, and I think we have to be that way. Probably has to do with something about how we believe the roots of that community differ.
There are efforts that are created to maybe reframe parts of history from authors who may or may not have an agenda, who may want to write or create or artistically contribute to different topics for a certain reason. How can we know what we are hearing is accurate? We're often counseled when we listen to news, we should consume news from multiple sources so that we can then make a judgment. It's a little more tough to do sometimes with history because we may not have as many sources. We may have the one that's presenting an idea to us.
Yeah, so it's very challenging. So part of the answer is you need multiple sources, but the question is what sources, right? I tend to say, I'll put it this way. A lot of times what is a very popular history book, I'm not always a fan of. There are exceptions, I mean, but a lot of times a popular history book is maybe not as well researched, but tells a story that we want to hear. And that to me, you know, you're starting to get into a gray area there of how well is it really researched. Now, there is some exceptions to that. There is, like, for example, Battle Cry of Freedom, which is about the Civil War, very well researched and very well written. But often you don't find that. So sometimes if it's popular, especially on political circles, in a certain political circle, I don't care which side or whatever it is, that I would be a little skeptical also. You know, so the way I would kind of approach it is you need not only multiple sources, but I tend to like well-researched books. And what I mean by that is having footnotes, endnotes, and so on and so forth. And then there is more than one way to interpret the research. There's no one accurate way to see it. There can be multiple accurate ways depending on whose perspective you're looking from in the historical figures. I would like to read multiple sources from well-researched, meaning I want to see footnotes in the book, type of things. Now, I hesitate about history articles in popular journalism outlets unless they're written by a historian, because honestly, journalists don't always do a great job at history because they tend to find a few sources and interpret them with our lens, and they don't have the context of that era to place those sources within. So that's another thing I look for. If I'm looking in some sort of publication that's not a book, I'm going to be looking for, well, is this person actually a historian, or are they, you know, some maybe a journalist or a social commentator that is making comments about history, that's a little bit different. That's challenging because, again, very easy to take quotes and evidence out of context. And they might be trying to push a particular thesis or in a particular outcome that they're looking for. So those are some of the things I look for. There are also some wonderful online digital projects you can go to. And I don't mean kind of blog posts per se, but there are some places where you can literally gather data. Like, for example, you go to the Library of Congress website or the National Archives website, and you can look firsthand at primary sources if you like. Not everything is digitized, but there is a lot of stuff digitized that you can access and look at directly yourself, which is not from a historian. That's you engaging directly with the material, but there's nothing wrong with doing that either, so you can see things for yourself.
Rafi, do you tend to gravitate towards those topics that make you uncomfortable or that make you comfortable? And what is your advice to folks when they're looking at history? We all have to be, I guess, we have to be economic with our time. We don't have time to learn about everything. We can either learn about things that make us uncomfortable and think or that we're very comfortable with and we want to maybe, I guess, reassert what we believe our knowledge to be. Do you have advice to folks that are looking around at historical narratives and what they should look at?
I do. So I would encourage people to look at something that makes them uncomfortable because I have this saying, I say, whatever you believe, history disagrees. And that suggests that we are often going to be uncomfortable with what we're studying in history because history is a vast tapestry of different peoples, different actions, competing interests, different perspectives. And therefore, it is much more complex than fitting into any one neat belief that we have. And often what happens, we look backward, looking to validate our current outlook on the world, not just in politics, social, whatever it is. And if you're doing that, trying to catch yourself to not do that, but trying to perhaps do the opposite and say, well, what is a wide array of things in history that can help me see differently? That is how I would approach things. Now, in terms of being economical with time, that's exactly, and I don't mean to self-promote here, but that's exactly why a class like this is very valuable because I'm bringing it all together for you. And it is going to be economic in that sense. I mean, we're going through weekly sessions. I have different guest speakers in part to have different perspectives. That's exactly why I bring in different guest speakers so you don't hear only from me. That's really important. And a couple of my guests, one of my guests is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winner. Another one is a two-time Bancroft Prize winner. And so in the process, I'm bringing you access to these people, very well-known folks.
We are visiting with Rafi Andonian. He's presenting through Humanities North Dakota, a series of 13 virtual classes using the Zoom platform on contested histories in remembering Americana. Rafi, today, do you think Americans care more or less about history?
I think in the last 2 years, I think more. I don't think it's always more accurate, but I do think that they care more because I think ever since the monument stuff happened a couple of years ago, I think there was this renewed interest in history. And as you know, we're fighting over it all the time still. There's all kinds of conversation about history curricula that is being debated in the rhetoric, both at the state level and national level, regularly. We keep seeing that. That's one of the most divisive issues is the history curriculum that we're going to teach. And so I think that in the last 2 years, 2.5 years, ever since the events with the monument issue that flared up, we are more interested in history as a topic. However, I don't think we're more interested in more accuracy. I think a lot of times people approach this renewed interest in a way that is to, as I mentioned, validate what they already believe. And I would encourage people to look at it from multiple perspectives. Usually the reality is a little more gray and isn't so black and white. And that's part of what I get at in this class as well. And so I do think that we have that renewed history. I do worry, though, what we're doing with the renewed interest if we're on accuracy or if we're kind of drifting from that to try to beat up the other guy that's on the other side.
What role now is social media playing in how we consume history from your perspective?
It's good and bad. Everything has a trade-off. So on the positive side, you know, you have more access than ever before. There are some good social media projects that are going on in history. You can encounter fascinating stories. Sometimes sometimes you follow a museum or something like that and access their collections or their exhibits from sitting right in your living room. I love that. However, you know, there's also all kinds of stuff that has unverified sources that's floating around. Quotes from Abraham Lincoln and George Washington, quotes from Churchill, quotes from, you know, all Martin Luther King. And a lot of times those quotes are actually inaccurate. The person never said them, or at the very least, they're out of context. And so you have to be very careful with those quotes that are floating around. If you see a quote like that, I would encourage you if to try to find where that quote is from, because usually the quotes are very easy to find in some sort of primary source document that may actually be online from an archive. So it's not hard to find that. But a lot of times those quotes from well-known historical figures are either inaccurately portrayed out of context or sometimes just straight up false. They just put a name on it to get attention to it. So you have to understand social media is a marketing medium. So there's always going to be some sort of agenda behind the post. Even the museum has some sort of agenda behind the post. Their agenda could be a benign one, like education. So I'm okay with that. But you always have to be careful with who's posting what and where the sources are from. So I would always consume these things with a grain of salt. You want sometimes they're funny. You want to share it because it's fun. Okay. But I would never hang on to it and cling on to it as a truth. And I would always be open to seeing something else in the future that might actually be that.
What's your take on Wikipedia?
I like, again, plus and minus. So I like that Wikipedia can maybe introduce you to a topic at a very high level and give you a few pointers that you might maybe further research. However, you know, again, not always reliable because you don't know who's writing what. Yes, sometimes I have footnotes, not always, but sometimes I have footnotes. But if you dig through to those footnotes sometimes and you click on them and chase them down, it's not exactly what the person writing there is saying. So you got to, if you're going to really rely on it, you got to chase down those footnotes and you'll see that, I'm not sure that's saying exactly what is portrayed on Wikipedia. So, you know, however, as an introduction to know something exists or is like the very top, very basic level, it can be useful, but I would use it as a starting point to then take those concepts and do deeper research if I'm actually trying to verify the information beyond a surface level.
Are there one or two online tools that are your go-to to, it may be Wikipedia, but there might be one or two others that give you that solid introduction, a platform or a springboard to learn more?
Absolutely, yeah. So it depends on the topic. I mean, is there a particular topic that you're interested in
that
you're asking about?
Not necessarily, but I think generally for history, for people that want to maybe learn something new every day or learn something new once a week, a good resource for them to use as a springboard.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So if you're looking for something that's once a day, once a week, I actually think jstor.org is a really good one, jstor.org. And if you go on there, they have so technically JSTOR is a database of various academic articles and publications. However, you don't have to go digging into the archives, and there's free tools on there that you can get something called JSTOR Daily or Weekly, and they send some publicly accessible short articles, web blog posts, etc., that give you introductions to topics. And then often what I like about that is within that short article, there'll be some links that if you do want to kind of dig a little deeper, you can click on those links and dig a little deeper. They even have a free membership that allows you a certain number of academic articles if you want to go down that route per month. I think it's like 10 or 15 or something. But you don't even have to go that far. If you just want a simple web page, you know, half a page article to you every day, you could go to JSTOR. And what's really great about that is that it's so vast, you can pick the subtopic you're interested in. And that to me is valuable so that you actually get material that you like.
From your perspective, why is history so important? And why should we really consider having history as part of our daily life?
Well, I would ask people to consider two ways. There's my perspective, and then there's a perspective that you might have, and you as the listener. I would ask, why do you think that we are fighting so much over history? If sometimes you hear history is boring or it's in the past, well, if it's really in the past and irrelevant, then why is it that that appears to be the number one school subject we fight over? Whether it's the textbooks, the 1619 curriculum, the 1776 curriculum that came out as a counter to that, who we include in the textbooks, what narratives we include in the textbooks, how we portray them in the textbooks, monuments, why do we fight over monuments so much? So whatever that answer is for you is why history is important for you. From my perspective, my answer is because it tells us who we are. It shapes our identity. That's why when we refer to history, we often refer to the first so-and-so, the first time we had Thanksgiving, or the founding fathers. You know, these are all things we refer to because it shapes who we think we are. And who we think we are is interconnected with our identity. And our identity is, of course, our past that leads to our present. I'll add another layer to that and say, literally everything around you, not just social institutions and the physical environment, but including what you believe, has a history to it. And there's a reason that you believe what you do. We could go so far as you believing that you can read the Bible for yourself has a historical moment that belief changes. If you were alive maybe 600 years ago, you wouldn't think that. So there are some importance that are literally in your daily life. If you like to read the Bible, for example, that is in your daily life because of history. Or if you're obviously, you know, in the United States, with the freedoms that we say that are human rights, that's because of history. There's nothing else there that kind of shapes our belief. If you were alive maybe 300 years ago, you wouldn't necessarily think that way because there isn't that belief system there. But also understanding why society is the way around you. Why is your city planned the way that it is? Why, you know, are certain businesses where they are? There's so many ways that history is shaping what is around us and who we think we are, and our role in the world, and our role in our community.
Rafi, it's been a pleasure to visit with you. Rafi Andonian will be teaching Contested Histories in Remembering Americana through Humanities North Dakota. That 13-week virtual class begins on February 8th, and it is free. You can learn more at Humanities North Dakota's website. Rafi, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you all for giving me an opportunity to share this.
Speaking of history, up next is our own history segment, Dakota Datebook.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 6th. On this date, in 1897, the Fargo Society column in The World, a black newspaper in the Twin Cities, printed the following. The HPC met Friday and gave a fine entertainment at the residence of Mrs. E. Hayes on Front Street, and the program was well rendered by all who took part. The HPCs are going to have a banquet on the evening of February 20th, and a good time is anticipated. This is the last known literary reference to a mysterious black social organization in Fargo called the HPC Lodge. The year before, on May 16th, the paper's Fargo column reported that the HPC Lodge had 26 members, with an initiation scheduled for July 6th. In September, The World reported the HPC had a hayrack party Monday, and it was enjoyed by everyone who attended. They left the residence of Mr. and Mrs. Frost about 9 o'clock and drove all of Fargo's paved streets and went to the residence of Mr. and Mrs. Selby on 11th Street South, where a large table was spread with all the delicacies of the season. Dancing and games were indulged in until a very late hour, and they all went home after having spent a very pleasant evening. The HPC Lodge held a spelling bee on October 9th, staged a minstrel show soon before Christmas, held a banquet on Christmas evening, and may have given a jubilee concert soon after New Year's. According to the January 9th edition of The World, a happy crowd of young folks gathered at the residence of Mr. and Mrs. L. Fort to rescue the presents from the Christmas tree, which was given by the HPC. Everyone got a present, as there were 200 presents given away. On January 22nd, it was reported that the HPC Lodge took in 5 new members. By every indication, the HPC Lodge was a thriving black fraternity during the late 1890s. It had men, women, young and old, yet the World Society columns appear to be the only known literary references to it. Even the meaning of the letters HPC is a mystery. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Hi, I'm Jack Zaleski. I'm the former editorial page editor and a current columnist for the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, and I've been a newspaper man for life. But no matter what the media and public radio is included, journalism is a vital pillar of democracy. We're seeing what happens with a superpower whose leader goes unchecked by a free and independent press. We've seen democracy and the media under attack right here in this country. It is always important to support your trusted sources of journalism. So keep reading and subscribing to your area newspapers, digital or in print. Become a member of your local public radio station, Prairie Public. And we journalists will continue to seek the truth no matter what we uncover.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street. February is Black History Month, and tomorrow we'll hear from Dr. Larry Napoleon, an associate professor in the School of Education at NDSU. We'll learn about the history of Black History Month and the thought behind this year's theme, Black Resistance. Also, Dr. Scott Acton, a Wavefront scientist for Ball Aerospace, spent decades of his life working on the James Webb Space Telescope. The telescope launched from Earth Christmas Day in 2021 and has performed well beyond expectations since. Dr. Acton discusses his incredible history with the project and tells us what may be next for one of the country's most brilliant physicists. Remember, you can hear all episodes of Main Street on our website at prairiepublic.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great rest of your day.